Now to one of my favourite discussions of the month, our monthly foreign affair, where three guests nominate a significant event that has interested them over the past month. And, well, there hasn't been a month yet that you would describe as quiet in this arena of international affairs and our position in it. So joining us today is Alex Oliver. Alex is the director of the respected Lowy polling program at the Lowy Institute. Her last poll, for instance, included a look at Australian attitudes towards America and Donald Trump, which is always interesting. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Geraldine.
Alan DuPont is a well-known voice to guide us through global politics. He's the CEO of the Cognoscenti Group and I think well-known by to Radio National listeners for his analysis. Hello, Alan.
Geraldine, how are you?
And joining us in Melbourne is Jenny McGregor. Jenny is the CEO of AsiaLink at Melbourne University. AsiaLink is Australia's largest non-government centre for the promotion of Asia-Australia relations. Good morning to you, Jenny.
Good morning, Geraldine.
So let's look back over the past month. And Alex, you have been intrigued by the restructure of our intelligence and security agencies into this super ministry, the Home Affairs Ministry, to be headed by Peter Dutton, taking charge of ASIO, the Federal Police, Immigration and Border Security. Now, it's an idea that's been considered by both sides of politics for the past 15 years, one way or the other. Here's the Prime Minister announcing the change.
Today I'm announcing the most significant reform of Australia's national intelligence and domestic security arrangements and their oversight in more than 40 years. We can't take an if it ain't broke, don't fix it approach to security arrangements, not least because our adversaries are agile and nimble.
We'll believe this is a good idea when the experts tell Labor it's a good idea.
The opposition leader, Bill Shorten, awaiting expert advice. Now, Alex, people have been casting verdicts on this, and it's been quite interesting to read the shifting tone, I would suggest. What's yours?
My initial reaction was probably that of, you know, around about half of the people who responded to this was, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And it's a shame, really, that the sort of the political, the realpolitik, that sort of cloud has clouded the issue, and that the initial response was, this is just political, this is a beleaguered administration trying to shore up its conservative element, and this is an appeasement to the conservative side of politics, therefore making, you know, Peter Dutton the uber minister. But thinking about it longer and reading what analysts like Alan, who've analysed in great depth, I'm convinced that it's probably the right way to go. I mean, there are some advantages and there are some risks. And the risks are that in creating this ministry, there are issues of imbalance. The border and immigration side of that ministry are huge, and there's lots of sort of process issues, the visas and the discretion and the decisions about those sort of immigration issues, and, you know, risk sort of crowding out the other important, the sort of the core policy functions of such a ministry. But the advantages are, and they're the ones that the Prime Minister has talked to, and I believe that he's been thinking about it for quite a while. So this is not just something that's been created out of this political sort of fiasco. More resources, better coordination, and better connectivity between these agencies. So what we used to have were, you know, sort of intelligence functions that were not necessarily coordinated. And the Prime Minister pointed out, and this is a reality, I think, of our security atmosphere and environment at the moment, that domestic and international security issues are no longer distinct. The line has blurred. You know, we all know that. So we now have, you know, returning foreign fighters, we have domestic terrorism issues, we have international intelligence issues, we have a cyber threat, we have these diabolical complex intelligence problems, and bringing them under one head and one group is a good idea. And the creation of this Office of National Intelligence, as opposed to Office of National Assessments, I think is probably key to that, and Alan can certainly talk to that.
Well, Alan, I want to hear your view. It seemed, when I was reading about it, that some people felt that a proliferation of different advice was good for the country and good to go into Cabinet. Others felt that focusing it was better. So it's quite an interesting dilemma, that, isn't it?
Yes, if you pose it that way, it is. But I don't see it in those terms. See, I think you can have a diversity of opinion, contestability within the agencies, but what the government wants to hear is an integrated view, allowing for differences. It doesn't want to have multiple views on complex issues because it just makes it so difficult to develop policy and operational responses. You've got to remember that the intelligence and national security community has grown enormously over the last 20 years. I mean, by some estimates, roughly one-third of the government is now in the national security community. that's unprecedented for us. You know, 20 years ago, it was three or four departments. That was it. It was a boutique issue. Now it's front and centre. It affects just about all policy when you think about it now. So what's happened is the community's grown up in an ad hoc way, and it needs to be brought into the 21st century, modernised, centralised to some degree, but you still want to maintain the elements of the system that are good, which are the contestability parts and the professionalism and expertise. And I think this reform, and I do see it as a reform, does exactly do that.
Jenny, have you got any thoughts?
Look, it's a very contested issue, obviously, Geraldine, and there's probably no right answer, is there? It's to do with implementation, the effectiveness, and to do with either within a major ministry or within a group of individual ministries, how well that coordination
the
takes
execution.
Place.
Yes, yeah, I mean, Laura Tingle, who's been writing very interestingly about it, and she made the point that by having this new super ministry, we lose for the first time since the war a minister for immigration. That crucially important ministry portfolio is subsumed into this new ministry. And her thesis was that actually immigration is so important for Australia, but it's to do with population, this very delicate area of population, Alex. And I'm just reading from her piece actually last week. The reality is that neither major party knows exactly how to frame a discussion about our population without igniting ugliness from various quarters who might jump in with their own agendas. So this is a sort of sidebar, very interesting, I think. It's not, in other words, just about sort of security and intelligence. Other things get taken into it as well.
That's a very good point. Now, one thing that hasn't been resolved, and a lot of the implementation that Jenny mentioned is yet to be addressed, and there'll be a task force, and this is not going to come into force until sort of early 2018 at the earliest. So there's 6 months at least of work to do as to how to do this, to sort of corral the immigration functions and those important process functions from the policy making on the security side. But of course, population is a huge issue now, and that is something that I think we need to address, because I think a lot of Australians are unaware of the fact that we have one of the highest immigration rates in the developed world. That excludes the sort of natural replacement. And attitudes towards immigration are changing. There's been a slight shift we've noticed in our own public opinion work about how Australians feel about immigration. We're still broadly pro-immigration. It has to be separated from the issue of refugees and asylum seekers, which is, you know, a toxic problem, which is separated. But the issue of actually policy on how big Australia should be and whether that migration program should be sustained at the levels it currently is, and what the focus of that migration program are going to be, you know, skilled migration, the 457 visas issue. These are all things that need to be addressed very seriously. And
if I can just say one thing, Geraldine, you've got to be careful not to characterise the new Department of Home Affairs as only a national security agency or body. Okay, so if you look at the British model, the British have brought their immigration department essentially into the Home Affairs area, just as what we've done now. So it's not that you're securitising immigration. You're taking immigration to Home Affairs because a lot of immigration policy touches on all the issues we've been talking about, border security, national security and so on. Yes, of course, there's an economic and social dimension to that
too.
Some
of immigration policy touches on that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But the point is that it doesn't mean it can't be addressed within this new department, right? That would be my point. And I think that's the way the Brits see it.
Okay. Now, Alan, you would like us to look at this much underreported issue, I think, of the tense standoff between India and China along part of their vast 3,500-kilometre shared border. Now, the two nations fought a war, we have to recall, over that border in 1962, which is not so long ago, and there are some unresolved disputes. Here's the China Global Television Network's interpretation.
It's been over a month since Indian troops crossed into Chinese territory in the border region, and the resulting standoff is still ongoing.
We have a clear and open information channel with each other, but we hope the Indian side can take concrete action and practical efforts. The current situation is India is violating the basic principle of international relations as well as the international order, and is damaging the peace and stability in the boundary area.
What is behind this latest row, Alan, in your judgment?
Well, look, ultimately it's a contest about who is going to be the dominant power in Asia. Is it going to be China and India? That's the bottom line. So you have to see these border disputes and skirmishes within that context. So if you go back to 62, basically there is two parts of the border between India and China that are disputed. They're basically up in the high Himalayan or Tibetan plateau. So war is fought out there at sort of a 3,000-metre altitude. So it's a pretty inhospitable place, right? Okay, the Indian sensitivity is that the Chinese have been building an extensive road network into Tibet and right down to the border with Bhutan, which is essentially a client state of India.
Poor little Bhutan is in the middle of all this.
It's squashed sort of in between China and India. You wouldn't want that, you know, as your future. So the problem is that bringing this road right up to the border threatens, in Indian eyes, this very narrow corridor that connects the main part of India up with its northeastern states. It's called the Chicken's Neck. It's about 20-kilometre-wide corridor. And they believe that China is now threatening that corridor. And, of course, the area there is disputed, hasn't been resolved. So that's the essential initial cause, if you like, of this. But it goes well beyond that. So the big questions are, why is China building this network? Why would they choose to upset the Indians at this particular stage? And this is what the Indians are debating themselves. We don't know the answer to that, but it appears to be related to China pursuing its One Belt, One Road policy, pushing through to connect up all of Central Asia with Europe. This is the big ambitious Silk Road project. And India has resisted that because India feels that China is essentially surrounding it on land and at sea. So the Indians are now very sensitive to this whole issue.
And both nuclear powered. Jenny, how do you see it?
Geraldine, it's a very tense issue, this one. And I think the whole issue of the Belt and Road Initiative is causing great... it's the biggest project we've ever seen, probably globally, isn't it? It's a huge...
Whatever it turns out to be.
yeah. Described by the Sultan of Perak as a grand design. And I think it's interesting to see all of the neighbouring views about this grand design, and to see that in Southeast Asia, actually, and in North Asia too, there's a welcoming of it to an extent that we haven't really seen in Australia. And we've been doing some work on that currently, getting views from leading thinkers in the region. There's certainly enthusiasm for the project, but also a wariness.
Look, it's interesting because we've seen so little about all this, but obviously it is worrying people. The video emerged earlier this week, said to show opposing sides at the site shoving and jostling each other. It escalated further with a senior Chinese defence official quoted as saying to India, "Do not push your luck." So it had these sort of, the atmospherics were just not ideal. I mean, Alan, maybe we've got to get used to this a bit more and not overreact, because we wouldn't want them to come to fighting, would? I mean, that'd be dreadful.
No, well, clearly not. I mean, as you pointed out, both countries are nuclear-armed states. So, I mean, you're always in the back of a mind, you've got to remember that. So it's no one's interest for this to develop into a full-blown war. And I don't think either China or India want that either. But this is another example of China pushing the boundaries, if you like, because it can do so. It's doing quite assertively all across the world. The Chinese want us to get used to that, and some countries will and some countries won't.
Well, see, there's other reporting, for instance, from The Diplomat, saying that why the Chinese are apoplectic about this is that they did advise the Indian government that they were going to be building this road, you know, some details of it, and there was no pushback. And then when it actually came to it 3 weeks later, the Indians did engage on sort of stepped over the boundaries of the border, and that this changed the perceived rules.
Well, the Indians argue the opposite. They argue that basically China broke the status quo. So there had been an agreement not to change or push the border. And building this road from an Indian perspective and from Bhutan's perspective too did exactly that. So the point is, both sides will make their arguments. The issue is, how serious is this?
And who might step in? Who might be an honest broker, an interlocutor? That's part of the problem too. Who does it?
Well, there's no one really who can be an honest broker between China and India, to be frank. They're going to have to sort it out between them.
Dangerous.
So it's another one of those flashpoints that are going to impact on Australia too, because they're both major trading partners in our part of the world. So that's another thing to worry about.
Well, look, we might also be encouraged to worry about what's happening in the Philippines, the assault by Islamic militants on the city of Marawi. And I have to say, I've been very personally aware of this because my son-in-law, Adam Harvey, the ABC correspondent, was shot in the neck while covering the conflict for the ABC. And there's a story that he's doing on it on a foreign correspondent on Tuesday night. But a report from the Jakarta-based Institute for Policy Analysis, interestingly, this week, has confirmed fears that other ultra-radical groups, they suggest, are uniting around the siege, emboldened by the inability of the Filipino and US forces to quell the conflict, and that Mindanao, which has been rumbled on for so long, could become more than it has been. Now, I mean, Alex Oliver, it's probably not been your specific sphere of interest, but people like David Petraeus, General David Petraeus, said this is what the Australians are going to have to take very close care of. Yes, the Americans won't necessarily. Is that right?
Well, that's the issue. If America does sort of withdraw from Asia just through lack of attention, lack of discipline and lack of interest on behalf of the new administration, that they are not sufficiently focused on this. This is something that we've been working on for a few years. It was highlighted in a paper a couple of years ago that one of the big risks to the region, ASEAN nations in particular, and Southeast Asia broadly, was going to be returning fighters. The idea that ISIS was going to be defeated was always pretty much certain. It's been a fact on the ground for the last year. But what happens when those fighters return to their countries? A lot of them came from Indonesia. Some of them came from other nations in Southeast Asia. Some of them came from Australia, with several hundred of them of ours. That is a fear that is now materialising very close to home, whereas terrorism has been for Australians, a more remote threat. Mm. And we've sent, Australian troops to deal with, manage, coordinate, plan, assist in Syria and Iraq. But now this has become a really big issue for our region.
Well, Alan, I think it's early this coming week, six regional governments, us, New Zealand, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines and Brunei, are meeting in North Sulawesi in Indonesia to discuss how to address this risk of returning fighters. I suppose if we look on a glass half full way, this could lead to cooperation that doesn't already exist, question mark?
Yes, I think it can and will, because it's in nobody's interest for this insurgency to grow and spread from Mindanao into the region more broadly. So everyone understands the threat, but it's not that easy to stop it. It's not just a question of the foreign fighters returning, which is obviously a worrying dimension, but it's more the case of the Marawi sort of insurgency acting as a magnet and drawing in people from within Southeast Asia, jihadist groups, the sympathisers, flocking to the cause, so to speak. And suddenly the whole situation goes from just a small city in the southern Philippines to actually becoming, the spark that sets off a region-wide insurgency. And then you've got the prospect of a caliphate in Southeast Asia. And that's the long-term concern. So what can we do about it? I mean, the first thing we need to understand is what is actually going on there. The intelligence is very poor. And so I think Australia's got a role to play in helping to build up a really detailed intelligence picture of where are these people coming from? Where's the money coming from? How were they able to do this? Essentially attack a 200,000 person city.
Take it
and
over.
Defy the Philippines armed forces. It's been going on for nearly 2 months now. They still haven't actually snuffed it out. So how did all this happen? Did this come out of the blue? Well, obviously not. So we need to have a better picture. Secondly, I think the role for Australia here is not to put boots on the ground per se in an operational right way, but to actually help train the Philippine armed forces in urban warfare. Because you see, the wars of the future in Southeast Asia won't be in the jungles as they were in the past, they'll be in the cities.
Jenny McGregor, it is interesting that the fact that the Philippine army keeps saying they're on the verge of solving it, and they don't. That, I mean, people like the Singapore Prime Minister sort of basically told me when we went up there for the Shangri-La dialogue, this is really focusing the mind of authorities in Asia looking on.
Yes, Geraldine, and I think that your point about cooperation is absolutely key here. It's a real opportunity as well for Australia to yet again demonstrate that we can effectively collaborate with our ASEAN counterparts and address these major issues. The example of Timor, where, you know, Australia is often credited for that issue, and really it was not Australia alone, it was Australia in a very effective collaboration with ASEAN.
Mm. Now I want to come to what you've suggested we look at, which is related, Jenny. Indonesia's President Joko Widodo has instructed law enforcement officers to shoot drug traffickers who resist arrest, saying the country faces a narcotics emergency. So this is emerging as quite a debate. Here's a Reuters report.
Echoes of the bloody anti-drugs campaign in the Philippines as Indonesian President Joko Widodo instructs police to shoot traffickers. The Southeast Asian country is struggling to contain a narcotics crisis. The new order drawing comparisons between Widodo and Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. The country's police chief has echoed Widodo's message, saying he's ordered officers not to hesitate when it comes to using lethal force.
Now, we should just be clear that it's actually drug traffickers who allegedly resist arrest. It's not all drug traffickers, Jenny, but it's certainly language we haven't heard from Indonesia, isn't it?
Absolutely, Geraldine. The reason it really resonated with me was that we run an annual ASEAN Australia New Zealand dialogue, and the recent dialogue, the Filipinos actually put the whole issue of Duterte's war on drugs on the table. And I must say there was extraordinary surprise amongst the Australians about the sympathy that our ASEAN dialogue partners had for Duterte's response and approach. It really reinforced for us this difference. There was such a sympathy for his absolute commitment to winning this war. This was to be his major legacy for his presidency. And the fact that there are somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 people killed already in this war in the Philippines, and then that's being picked up in Indonesia, it just, I suppose, for me, really reinforced the fact that it's so important for us to be listening and sitting down with the Asian counterparts and really understanding where they're coming from and what's driving the approach.
I hear what you say, but what did you say to the notion that people could be shot on sight without any trials, etc.?
Yes, yeah.
It's an incredible challenge to values.
It certainly is a challenge, and we, of course, were careful in the way we approached it because of the passion, the whole issue about how much of the drug ice, in particular shabu, is going into initially the Philippines and now increasingly into Indonesia, and how available it is and how many people are being killed as a result of that, dying from the effects of the drug.
So that was the evidence was brought forth, was it?
Yeah. And it's not so. Therefore, you know, it's quite difficult to condemn. Of course, we wouldn't support extrajudicial killings. But on the other hand, it's also possible to understand that different approach. It is a real challenge for us.
See, Alan, I notice in some of the reporting, the anti-narcotics chief general Wayoso, Commissioner General Wayoso, I think it is, from Indonesia, had very, very strong language. He actually said, in our exposure of drug-related money laundering, we found indications of involvement of state apparatus. We're talking about rogue elements here. Well, what's that all about?
Well, there's a couple of things happening here, Geraldine. First of all, for the last 20 or 30 years, Southeast Asia had a major drug problem, but these Southeast Asian states were essentially transit countries for drugs coming to Australia and other developed countries. Now what's happened is they've got a problem themselves. And that's really brought it home to governments in the region that, you know, it's killing a lot of our own people as well. So that's one of the reasons why there's such a focus on this and why Duterte really took fairly precipitate action after he became president. So that's the first thing that's happening. Yes, in terms of states being involved, I mean, it is pretty common knowledge that North Korea has been involved in drug trafficking for a long time. So I wouldn't see that as being the major problem. It's essentially transnational criminal organisations making a lot of money from drugs, and they now see Southeast Asia as a market for these drugs because they're becoming more developed, richer, and therefore a bigger middle class. So before they were just going through these countries to Australia, for example, and now they're not. So that's really brought this home to Southeast Asian governments, and it's a growing problem. And of course, it's a big one for Australia too, as we know.
Yes, but we discuss it. I mean, does this come up in your polling at all? I mean, no.
No, except to the extent, obviously, that it may ultimately affect the reintroduction or the restarting of the execution program in Indonesia, which is suspended shortly after the Australians were executed. So developments like that are obviously of concern, where this extrajudicial killing program extends to other countries in Southeast Asia, and then human rights issues obviously come to the fore, and the question is who stands up for those human rights.
Well,
and,
quite.
We've been very firm on the death penalty, but we wouldn't want to see another, you know, major program of executions for drug trafficking offences. So it affects us to that extent. What stance does Australia take here?
Well, I suppose, Jenny, you know, finally, it, in a way, I think what you're alluding to is this values or possible values gulf, which, of course, really plays out in terms of foreign policy. And in a way, we have learned, I would suggest to you here in Australia, to debate drugs differently. You know, there's a more of a welfare approach, I suppose, or the business of helping people move beyond their addictions. That's not what you've just described.
No, and yet in other areas, Geraldine, that is beginning to be discussed. So if we look at the relationships with our neighbours in terms of the health and welfare community dialogues, it's certainly being put on the table. There's a great understanding in many countries of the region of the need for looking at this as a health issue and approaching it quite differently. So I think we're at an interesting stage, and one that's got to be very delicately managed.
But quite a nice challenge for Australia too, if you think about it, again, to attempt to reframe the debate.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And interestingly, China has recently offered the Philippines $15 million for drug rehabilitation and law enforcement. I'm not sure what the proportion is in terms of rehabilitation versus enforcement.
And I mean, very, very quickly, Alex Oliver and I were both at the Boris Johnson dinner conducted by the Lowy Institute, and this certainly wasn't on the agenda, Alex, and that amazing show and performance by the British Foreign Secretary.
Yes, it was indeed a show. Alan was there too. I now want to go back and listen to it all in the sober light of day, because it was so entertaining. I think there was a lot of substance there that I'd like to go back to and listen to.
But you're not
again.
Sure.
I think we're waiting, Geraldine, for the British aircraft carriers to appear in the Straits of Malacca to save us all, right?
Which, as he said, longer than the Palace of Westminster, but we're not quite ready to bring them down just yet. It's very, very highly entertaining.
I think he said they're a lot more persuasive as well than the
Palace of Westminster. Jenny, Alex and Alan, thank you very much indeed for joining us for A Foreign Affair.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thank you. Thanks, Geraldine.
And Jenny and Alan and Alex all joined me late yesterday afternoon. Jenny, CEO of AsiaLink at the University of Melbourne. Alan, CEO of the Strategic Risk Consultancy Group, Cognoscenti Group, and Alex, Director of the Polling Program at the Lowy Institute.